first and foremost. The input, once we have acquired it, will help us to answer the questions who, what, when, and where. This is our raw data set. Okay, so this is fairly easy to follow. This is what we do with a computer, and this is ultimately what we do with our brain. Gathering data from an eclectic array of sources without prejudging it in order to answer the questions who, what, when, and where. The raw data. We're taking in the raw data without judging it. Step number two is the processing, and this is all important. Now, before we get to step two, let me say why people never usually make it to step two. Most people on the earth don't make it to step two in any way that resembles any accurate information processing at all. It's because there is so much of the building blocks, the grammar, the words, the raw data set, the knowledge itself, we are drowning in a sea of knowledge, in a sea of grammar, in a sea of these building blocks of information. There is so much in the world because there are so many people and so much has been created and written and put out there in different forms of media. Most people are so daunted by the task of even doing the input at all because it takes work and time. And they're even more daunted by the first sub-step of part two, which we're going to get to in a moment, the filtration system of the weeding out process of information which isn't viable or isn't necessary or is just patently false and, you know, is put out there as distraction or disinformation or actually has nothing to do with the solving of the problem that we really want to solve by even taking data in. It's irrelevant data. There's so much trash data in the system that people don't want to weed through it to get down to what they really need. So most people don't even go through step one because they say, oh, the truth is such a needle in a haystack, we'll never find it. So part two, processing, which is also logic, okay, in the classical interpretation and understanding in the esoteric sense, processing is comprised of three sub-steps, and I've identified these as filtration, correlation, and analysis of data. So first, the data has to be filtered. So now this is what the processor of the computer is doing. Once the information has been gathered, which is step one, data gathering, then we can filter it and say, this is irrelevant data. This does not have to do with what we are trying to get to. It's maybe a distraction, a form of disinformation. We could apply different techniques to do that, to understand logical fallacies. Okay, so this filtration system you could look at as the antivirus or the malware protector that is installed in a computer to make sure in the gathering process, in the part where it comes into the computer through input, that viruses don't get in to the mix. Okay, so that would be filtration. And that's a huge task in the modern world because there is so much false information out there. So we have to have our virus guards installed properly within ourselves so that information which will make us sick doesn't get taken in as mental food.
27 lawyers in the room. Anybody know post hoc, ergo, propter hoc? Josh?
Post, after hoc, ergo, therefore. After hoc, therefore, something else hoc.
Thank you. Nick?
After it, therefore, because of it.
After it, therefore, because of it. It means one thing follows the other, therefore it was caused by the other. But it's not always true. In fact, it's hardly ever true.
It was, let's anticipate, let's see if we can prevent another attack. That led to Afghanistan, it led to Iraq. It's led to the Patriot Act. It's led to electronic surveillance. It's led to changing our intelligence services. All that is very, very good. It was, let's see if we can prevent another attack.
He kept us safe.
9/12/01, till the time President Obama raised his right hand, January of 09, the man kept us safe.
You still have that banana in your ear.
What?
I said you still have that banana in your ear.
Yeah, Bert, I know.
You know? Ernie, why is that banana still in your ear?
Listen, Bert. I use this banana to keep the alligators away.
Alligators? Only there are no alligators on Sesame Street.
Right. Doing a good job, isn't it, Bert?
Hey.
you're about to see was not planned. There was no script, there were no writers, there were no cameras, no production crew, no lighting, no graphic artists, and no editors. The entire program just happened. There was a big bang in our production studio, and here we are.
Could you believe that? Of course you couldn't. Nobody in his right mind could.
If our democracy is working the way it's supposed to, and 90% of the American people agree on something, in the wake of a tragedy, you'd think this would not be a heavy lift. And yet some folks back in Washington are already floating the idea that they may use political stunts to prevent votes on any of these reforms. Think about that.
Demand a plan.
As an American.
As an American.
As an American.
For the children of Sandy Hook.
Demand a plan.
It's time for our leaders to act.
Demand a plan. Right now.
Right now.
You! Demand it!
Did you leave the economy better than you found it?
Look, I think when people look back on the Bush years...
Is that a fair standard?
The one thing people are going to remember the most is that he kept us safe. We have not been attacked since September 11th. The second is, as I said, Barack Obama should be thankful that he's inherited a world without Saddam Hussein in it.
Left-wing types out there openly advocating polygamy. And so the next thing is going to be incest, then it's going to be pedophilia, then it's going to be bestiality. I mean, this is just the progression that is inevitable.
Back in the 60s, we called such people pigs. Pigs. All they want is what they got, their stuff, and they want more of it. Is that what we're facing here, just greed? I'm talking about people who won't listen to you because they want more stuff.
Listen, Chris, I'm not into name-calling here. I think we've
well,
got
I am.
Fine, that's your job, not mine.
Some people in the Creighton area of Mobile say a leprechaun is taking up residence in their neighborhood.
To me, it looked like a leprechaun to me.
Eyewitnesses say the leprechaun only comes out at night. If you shine a light in its direction, it suddenly disappears.
I can't get this pressure point out of my head. Can't get this pressure point out of my head. I feel it in work, you know I feel it in bed. Can't get this pressure point out of my head.
Hi, everybody. This is Brett, and welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today is November 1st, and this is the continuation in our series on the Trivium. Today, we will cover logic, but before we get into all that, just a couple of quick notes on the introduction to today's show. The man that you heard at the very beginning, Mark Passio, I recommend checking out his work. He has a podcast called What on Earth is Happening? Passio. And as I mentioned before, we went down to Yale in New Haven, Connecticut a couple weeks ago and filmed a 10-plus hour natural law presentation that Mark did. And I walked away from it. I got to tell you, a big fan. Gene and I mentioned Mark's work, I think, a couple of times in this episode and maybe in the next episode. So I thought I would let him lead things off here. And it certainly relates to what we're going to be discussing. Following that, you heard a little compilation. Gosh, I like to do those little compilations of fallacies. But the first example where you hear Rudy Giuliani going on about how great police states are, and then you hear Jeb Bush at the Republican convention and some other Fox News guy talking about how George Bush kept us safe, right? This idea, and even though it's never explicitly stated, this all hints at the post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy that we were supposed to walk away from our televisions with this idea firmly in place at the end of the Bush administration. After the preemptive strike against the country of Iraq, America was free of further terrorist attacks on its own soil. Therefore, because of the Iraq war, we were kept safe from terror. Terror. And this also tied to rhetoric like, if we leave now, they'll follow us home and we're fighting them over there so we don't have to fight them over here. And I tell you, I scoured the tubes for a clear clip of somebody saying one of those things, and I just couldn't find it. So I hope the first part of that mashup there will work as a placeholder for the actual soundbite that I was looking for. Sorry about that. So anyway, let's move along. I said in our interlude episode that today's show is going to be very dense. And because of that, I want to make sure that I provide for you an outline here right up front so you can have certain expectations of the conversation that you're going to hear. But before we do that, I wanted to return to the essay that I read from in the first show, written by Dorothy Sayers, The Lost Tools of Learning. And remember, the reason why I wanted to share this in the first show is I liked how, for the purpose of our, you know, home educating parents or young autodidacts, Sayers offers some specific suggestions for how learning the trivium actually lines up with the development of a young mind. If this is something that interests you, I would just point you to The Lost Tools of Learning. You can definitely find a full text version of it online. It's in the show notes for this show. And, you know, I mean, if you are a home educator and you're looking for ways to incorporate the trivium into your learning environment, I recommend going and taking a look. Like I said before, you know, take what you like, leave what you don't. I did want to talk about a couple of takeaways from her discussion of logic, which goes on for several paragraphs, and also, you know, make some comparisons. We have this, you know, school sucks thing going on too, so make some comparisons between what can go on in a home educating environment and what goes on in these old schools. A couple of shows ago, I shared this piece about Common Core, where kids were being encouraged, very young kids, elementary school kids, were being encouraged to subtract two amendments from the Bill of Rights and add two of their own, which, as far as I'm concerned, is a process that comes, just to use simple terms here, at the end of the trivium, where you are ready to make a very important persuasive presentation to somebody else based on an accumulated body of knowledge and understanding. To me, that seems like the culmination of a long and arduous research process, not just a fun little assignment that you have a 10-year-old do one day. Take away people's liberties. I'm sorry, you know, if you're a big fan of all the exciting and creative new Common Core assignments, you know, I'm not trying to be a spoil sport. And we've seen all kinds of examples of this in school, how, you know, read this book and talk about how you feel about it, right? So things are always all out of order, and things are being loaded too much onto the third part of the trivium. And the trivium is still, even though it's never made explicit, we see many elements of the trivium in government schooling. But there are so many lost opportunities. In that article about the Common Core removed to amendments from the Declaration of Independence, they interview a mother. She says, my daughter doesn't know what the amendments are. Well, that's something that you would want to know first, right? Before you are given this all-important exercise of subtracting two of them when you're 10, it's a big decision for a 10-year-old, folks. So a lot of valuable learning opportunities skipped over there. And I just wanted to share one paragraph where Sayers is talking about history, logic and dialectic applied to history. And, you know, if this theology is mentioned a few times, like I said, take what you like, leave what you don't. History, aided by a simple system of ethics derived from the grammar of theology, will provide much suitable material for discussion. Was the behavior of this statesman justified? What was the effect of such an enactment? What are the arguments for and against this or that form of government? We shall thus get an introduction to constitutional history, a subject meaningless to a young child, but of absorbing interest to those who are prepared to argue and debate. Again, those who are prepared to argue and debate. And that whole speech that I just gave minutes ago about Common Core, that snapped right into my head as soon as I read that line. Now, I disagree with Sayers that history is automatically meaningless to a young child. I think that maybe some of these more advanced historical questions do require a foundation of knowledge to be in place. And, you know, maybe age six, just going back to the schools, is not the time that you start a study of history. If a young person is excited and interested about that subject, sure, why not? But I don't think it should be forced on kids the way it is in school, because then you also have this rationalization that usually boils down to something like, well, you can't expect children that young to understand all of these complexities of history or the truth about somebody like Columbus. So at this stage, it's more important that we just give them this mythology. But unfortunately, when these minds
are so malleable and so impressionable, that's what's captured as American history. The emotional resonance of those stories stays with most people their whole lives. What they learn, when maybe most of them are actually intellectually prepared to pursue a study of history, in when, you know, by the time they reach like middle school age or high school age, they're just drowned out in worksheets where they learn this is so boring after all the emotional power of the mythology is firmly in place. They learn that this is something so boring, I'd never want to look at it again. And most people never do. So I think this essay is an interesting resource. It provides some general guidelines, stress that word, general guidelines, for the implementation of the trivium in home education, or even in self-education. And obviously, you know, Gene has this interesting vantage point, and he'll tell this story in the series eventually, that, you know, he was learning this from a young age. Many of us were introduced to the concept of critical thinking, period, sometime in our 20s. But if, you know, I'll just stress that one more time, if people have found themselves kind of at a loss for like, well, I know I really want to help my young learner, or even help myself make this more explicit in my day-to-day thinking process, like I said, Lost Tools of Learning might provide a helping hand. So let's begin the show. And right up front here, I want to provide a little outline of my conversation with Gene. The first 20 minutes or so, we are going to be reviewing our previous discussion of grammar. The effect of grammar, again, is to produce primary, first-order knowledge of a subject. Now, during this time, while we're reviewing the grammar portion of the trivium, we have what I found to be a brief but very interesting discussion about what I'm going to call here the utility of mythology and the subjective thought process, and understanding mythology as a stepping stone to philosophy to develop a better understanding of the natural world. About 20 minutes in, this leads nicely to the discussion of the law of non-contradiction. And that's followed by a brief discussion of truth versus belief. You'll hear me say that truth is one of the most overused words in our language without a clear definition attached to it. We'll also talk about the confusing nature of the English language. There's a lot of vagary. There's a lot of abstraction. And this brings up a discussion of connotation versus denotation. And this is all happening in the first 35 minutes of the conversation. Next, we get into the four components of logic. So first, after a general discussion of reasoning, we will talk about the rules for deductive reasoning, and then the rules of inductive reasoning, and then the rules of definition, which we break down into genus and differentia, and then some familiar territory for many of us, informal fallacies overview. The informal fallacies are broken into three categories: fallacies of relevance, fallacies of presumption, and fallacies of ambiguity. And we give examples of each one. And that's how all this is going to go down. There are some time codes for this discussion in the show notes. If you're on a real tight schedule and you're like, you know, Brett, I only have time for genus and differentia today, I don't suggest doing things that way, but hey, I'll give you the option. The notes are time coded. All right, folks, hope you enjoy this show. Look forward to your feedback. Look forward to your questions. And, you know, if you do get into the Lost Tools of Learning, I look forward to hearing about any discoveries that come from that. All right, here's part two with Gene O'Denning.
It's a pleasure to be back with you, Brett. And I want to say, after listening to the way you assembled the first conversation, I'm glad that you took the direction that you did, first of all, by taking those excerpts from the novel 1984 and showing how language can be used to take reality, existence, and create another reality or existence, or that was the intent of the communication of the novel 1984. Because what we're really trying to do with the trivium is discern reality from unreality, just as Orwell was trying to illustrate in his novel. So one of the overall major thrusts in the trivium is to distinguish reality, objective existence, from unreality, which is really what we create in our minds. Now, at some point along our conceptual thought process, our unreality, which exists in our mind, may be in harmony with reality, but oftentimes it isn't. And so this is what we use the trivium for, to test what is objective reality from what I call imagination. A lot of people call it subjective reality. Mm-hmm.
To close the Venn diagram.
Yes.
Between belief and truth.
Correct.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and just on 1984, that's the theme that's so prevalent in that movie is the idea of doublespeak, mm-hmm. which in our, vernacular in the real world, not in the somewhat fictitious world of 1984, we got the term doublespeak. And the example that I used in the show of Greenspeak or FedSpeak, and obviously there's numerous examples of that. So all that being said about the language of 1984 and really the definitions and the redefinitions that are used to control people in that movie, before we get into the discussion of logic, we should do just a brief review of our first discussion on grammar. And I wanted to ask you what you think the most valuable takeaways were.
I think that the distinction between general grammar and special grammar, general grammar being the rules mm-hmm. of grammar themselves, and I'm going to address the parts of speech that exist within general grammar, and then special grammar, which is the use of those rules in different languages and in different courses of study or different subjects, as we call them, with their own lexicon. So the way that I have found to utilize grammar is with that sentence that describes what existence is. Existence is every substance, action, attribute, relationship that is, was, and ever will be. That's an easy definition and sentence to consider. And it's also the biggest thing that humans have in their purview. That pretty much covers it all. Now, to bring that back to grammatical parts of classification, that same statement can be said as existence is every noun, verb, adjective and adverb, and prepositional phrase in the three dimensions of time. So those nouns, verbs, adjective, adverbs, and prepositional phrases are, I misspoke the last time, these are really categorematic words, or words that pertain to existence, the existence that we see through our five physical senses.
Now, here's a question, though, that I could see somebody having about that. And this goes back to our brief discussion of the Venn diagram, where hopefully we have an increasingly large overlapping area between truth and belief. When we're talking about nouns, especially adjectives and adverbs, and maybe even verbs to a certain extent, there is a great deal of subjectivity that can enter into that word choice. So if somebody is unfamiliar, this is a question I could see being raised. Do all of these subjective valuations, can they be said to be part of existence?
They're part of unreality.
Mm, okay.
You see? Mm-hmm. Now, the things that we see through our five senses is where we start with our conceptual thought. Mm-hmm. And then, yes, we can take these things in. We look at a horse, a noun. It's a thing. Mm-hmm. Person, place, or thing. It's a thing. We look at a horse. It exists in objective reality. And then we might go to the sea or to an aquarium, and we see a narwhal whale. And that's the whale that has the horn sticking out of the middle of its forehead. And now we come back, and in our imagination, combine the two physically in our imagination, and we come up with a unicorn, which does not, never has existed, except within our mind. Mm-hmm. So this is what you must discern. What is imagination, even though those are nouns? And what is a noun in existence? So we're actually going back to the starting place. Where did the idea of our fictitious unicorn start? It started with two things that we see in objective reality. Objective reality is that which is. It's the existence which is there. Whether you believe in it or not, it was here before you were born, and it will be here after you depart. Mm-hmm. So these nouns, verbs, adjectives, a noun is a substance, a substantive. That's one way of defining a noun. If you parse the word itself, substance, stance means there's something that's standing or something that is perceivable. You can use one of your five physical senses in objective reality to perceive this thing. But there is also something beneath it. there is a, we can call it a subtext or a natural law. That there is a thing that stands, and then there is a thing that describes it. As we go through time and we use different means of looking at it, we start with a mythological, we make a person story out of it. Mm-hmm. Then we look at the thing itself and start asking questions of the thing itself within objective reality. That's called philosophy. And finally, we can manipulate or maybe even reproduce whatever that substance is by looking at the subtext. How have we developed that subtext? How complete is our explanation? Now we can go to an experimental process, which is a demonstration in objective reality to either reproduce or to modify that thing that stands along with a natural law that we have been able to discover over periods of time through various generations and progression in our knowledge and understanding. So these are the things that we must say that we start with, things that we perceive. I've used this example in the past, that before philosophy became widely used in antiquity, the idea was that there was mythology.
Personal difficulties, however, were often explained by some offense to the gods. Those who offended the gods were punished, not by some earthly authority, but by the gods themselves.
There's a Greek word, in fact, deisidaimonia, which means fear of the gods or respect for the gods. And this was a positive thing. Life was felt to be fairly precarious, and you needed to do everything you could to get whatever powers ruled the world on your side to keep safe. Many of them lived one drought away from starvation, and you just didn't mess around with a world like that.
Thales of Miletus was a philosopher who's considered the father of Western philosophy. And the explanation in Greece, he was a Greek philosopher, the explanation in Greece for an earthquake, for example, is that you're on an island and possibly this tremor occurs. So the idea is you look out and you see the earthly ocean, and it seems to be agitating as well. And because it's the same color and it's the biggest thing that man has in his purview, the biggest thing that he can perceive, also has a similar color, a color of blue, and it's the sky. The sky is the largest thing that we can see. So the idea was there was this god of the ocean and god of the sky. Now, the god of the ocean in Greece was
Poseidon?
Neptune. Yeah. Yeah, I think you're correct. Poseidon is the Greek. Well, we'll just call it Poseidon / Neptune.
Yeah, I can always confirm stuff like that in post-production. Minor details, and put an apology if necessary at the beginning. So
there was this personification of a phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Which is visible or perceivable to our senses, which is the ocean. Now, there is another god who is the over-god, and this is Zeus. He's the god of the sky, really the god of all existence, the chief god. So Zeus gets upset, and he starts to agitate the cosmic ocean, which then, because the cosmic ocean is tied, you can see it off in the horizon, the cosmic ocean is tied to the earthly ocean, and he's in league with Neptune. Neptune allows the earthly ocean to become agitated. And when it becomes agitated, the land becomes agitated. Mm-hmm. So now you, as people who are looking at these super humans, essentially, these personifications, you want to appease them. So you get the idea that there are sacrifices that you can do so that these earthquakes don't occur anymore. Well, Thales came back and he says, no, this idea that personifications have caused this with their own motivations, with their own emotions, is false. You have to look at the thing itself. So the ocean itself caused the tremor of the island, of the earth. Mm-hmm. Now, this is not a true explanation, but the point is because he has this system of open question and answer. What is? How do we know what is? What do we do? And finally, how do we explain it? You can take his idea of looking at the thing itself and continue to look for answers until you do fall upon the proper, or you get closer to the natural, the proper explanation that these laws that exist within the natural world are.
And therein we see the challenge, and we see why this has been so hard for so many to embrace, because it seems like we as a species, or we as a civilization, have this attraction to easy answers, whether we're talking about the ancient Greeks thousands of years ago, first trying to understand natural phenomena, and how unpopular this guy might have been at the time for this suggestion as a step in the right direction, right up to, people being spoon-fed mass media today. Easy answers seem to be what people desire. And when this counter to mythology is presented and say, no, at the very least, it's caused not by some supernatural force or the persona or emotions of a supernatural force. This is a natural phenomenon that we don't understand. That was probably very troubling.
It was, yeah. And Thales himself believed that the essence of all things was water, one of the ancient four elements, water being the one that he concentrated on. And of course, again, this is false, but through his thought process, later was developed this idea of the dialectic and the rules of logic. And you can continue to apply these questions and come up with what our understanding is today, that rather than it being a hydrodynamic situation that causes earthquakes, it's a volcanic geological phenomenon within the earth crust that causes these things. And in very specific geographical locations. So it's taken us quite a bit of time to come to that point. But again, it's through this development of our thought process, of our subjective thought process, continually trying to align with nature's laws, trying to discover, make the discoveries of nature's laws. And we're using this essentially the trivium of putting data together, undifferentiated data, but it is related, so we've got a subject. And now we have to come to a true understanding. And people don't really don't know what understanding is. And it's taking a complex set of ideas and removing any contradictions so that particular subject matter is of a whole, of a piece. One thing follows from another.
And this is the great challenge with the interface between man and nature is, as I've heard you say before, nature is free of contradictions. And I'll add this to it. Our minds, if we're not careful, can quickly fill up with them, which makes that interface far more difficult.
Let me take that one step further, sure. Because you'll hear a lot of people saying that our senses are fallible. Our senses deceive us. Now, our senses may vary from person to person. Some of us can see without corrective lenses. Others have a deficiency. Same with hearing, all of the other senses. We might have different degrees of development in our senses, but our senses give us the information that is around us. Mm-hmm. It is our interpretation of that information which deceives us, not the senses themselves.
Yeah, that was one of my first big challenges when I was introduced to objectivism and, the senses as the measure of reality, or the first piece of that process. And what I said when I first heard that was, well, infrared light and dog whistles,
Yes.
And so that was kind of a stumbling point for me.
Through instrumentality, we've come to see that there is such a thing as infrared light, and that there are natural creatures, animals, that are affected by it, or even plants. So we have found the spectrum above and below the visible. But as far as the human eye is concerned, for what it's designed for, the spectrum that it's designed to perceive, that is the information that's given to us. And of course, through science, we've developed instrumentality to perceive the other part of the spectrum of not only visible, but auditory.
Right.
And vibration, that which we normally feel through our sense of touch. And there are vibrations above and below our sensitivity to them. And through following our introduction to the universe, we have found that, that they're essentially what we're talking about right now are energy waves. And this is what makes up physical reality, matter and energy.
Mm-hmm.
And part of nature again. But yes, we're slowly, a little bit too slowly for the patience of most people who want the quick answers, we're slowly coming to them. And you're right, the mythological explanation for something is an explanation, and it's set in stone on top of that. Mm. There is no argument.
Right.
There is no argument with mythology. But there is an argument within philosophy and with the scientific mode of thinking. And that's the beauty of them, is that we can continue to advance. And we'll advance all the faster when we get a generation of people who are not necessarily looking for quick answers, who know that there is a process that is natural to them and can be focused more finely. And that's what the Trivium does. It focuses what you're already capable of doing. But it's the interruption right around the time of puberty when we're going to these various bureaucratic institutions, schools, religious training, various philosophies that want to have things set in stone because the answer is there. And now you can manipulate a population as you wish, as your whim dictates, as the objectivists would say.
And the setting in stone, just to go back a couple of minutes ago, I jumped in on you as you were about to define the law of non-contradiction. But that becomes, in what you're describing right now, that attempt to make that definition for most people is irrelevant because of this setting things in stone, which is, appeal to tradition, appeal to authority that we can get in a little bit later. But if people are wise to those tricks, they would set out on an effort to remove contradictions from what is presented to them one way or another.
Well, that is what a contradiction is. The law of non-contradiction is a thing cannot be itself and something else at the same time. And whenever you see that, or it's given to you by an authority, you have an uneasy feeling within you, and it's working on your emotions, and that's called cognitive dissonance. Mm-hmm. An emotion is pretty much automatic. It's kind of the mental equivalent of a perception, a percept. Open your eyes, you can't help but see. A noise is made, you can't help but hear it. That's automatic. And an emotion at its base level is automatic mm-hmm. to emotional beings. But the feeling that comes out of that can be likened to a conception. And this is cognitive dissonance. You've got this unease about you. You have an implicit knowing, or you have a question that you're holding a contradiction. And oftentimes you're holding that contradiction because the authority who sets things in stone for you or does your thinking for you says it is. But you have this feeling of unease, and this is the feeling of cognitive dissonance that your emotions are telling you. No, the fire engine over there is red, even though the authority who is double speaking to me says that mm-hmm. it's blue. So now you've got red and blue. Or a lot of people say, well, that's not true, because if you take a black and white photograph of a red fire engine, it's gray. It's some shade of gray. But if you think for yourself, if you have the rudiments of thinking for yourself, you say, no, this is a different circumstance. This is a photograph. This is a map of the territory. The red fire engine is the territory. The photograph is a differentiated map of that territory. And this gets us back to this idea of general grammar. There was a gentleman who came up with a discipline that was really describing general grammar, and he called it general semantics. His name escapes me right now, but it was quite popular for a bit of time. But semantics is that part of grammar which gives meaning. Well, it's actually part of the trivium, I should say, the integrated trivium. It gives meaning mm-hmm. to something. And then when you're discerning, when an individual, I've got to keep getting back to this idea of individuals, when the individual discerns something, it has to have a meaning to him so that he can see if it contradicts or not, or if it fits within his body of non-contradictory knowledge. And then some things are more important than others. And this is where you have to look at hierarchy itself. This is how to evaluate a situation or a life experience. What is more important? Is it more important that I go out and wash my dirty car right now, or that I come back in the house and feed my young child? So this is the evaluation that we're constantly making choices with. So those are the two components of meaning and accurate evaluation that we're faced with in the process of living.
I had a question, Gene, about truth versus belief. Just to go back to that diagram, as we've gotten this far into our discussion, I think it is imperative to give a definition to this word truth. It is one of the most overused words without a definition ever being attached to it. So if, you know, through this process, our goal is to arrive at truth, how do you define truth, an objective definition of truth?
That which communicates what is.
Okay.
Now, that's one definition. And if we were speaking, let's say, a synthetic language like Sanskrit, that was devised by a priesthood, so that each word, each utterance itself, had only one definition, we would be in a much clearer place than we are with these words that we use in the English language and other what have been called naturally formed languages, where we use the same word with different definitions. The simplest thing is, first you have to accept that there is objective reality, and then that which is in concurrence, which concurs with objective reality, is true. If it isn't true, we're back to this situation where A is not A, or the law of non-contradiction, or the law of contradiction. So you're contradicting, you're holding an imaginative substance in your mind that does not conform to objective reality. Now, the closer you get to the objective reality, the more true it is, or this word that we use for truth. And we have so many words that have so many different connotations. So this brings us to denotation and connotation. When someone utters the word truth, the start of the denotation is that it conforms with that which is objective reality. Now, it can connote, I'm holding an image of a unicorn in my head. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Yes, you see. Now, we're both holding this fictitious figment of imagination, which has been accepted through publication, essentially, through communication amongst us. But there is no such thing as an actual unicorn. Mm. So this is where we start going off into belief versus truth, because as children, we might be told to believe in something, and we do. But is that true? So as we start getting, you did a wonderful reading in the first show from Dorothy L. Sayers' The Lost Tools of Learning. And she mentioned in there the stage of the child, the Paul parrot, where all you want to do is parrot the people around you and your surroundings, whatever you come to see and know. And this is essentially just copying what you see all around you. Then you start asking the question. So you're copying the beliefs of other people, which don't necessarily conform to objective truth.
Now,
here's the confusion, is a lot of them do.
Right.
So when you get into the art of deception, the trick is to give you enough of objective truth within your argument that you get the audience on your side, and then you go off on some imaginable tangent, which does not conform to truth.
You know, it's interesting, too. I just add this there. It seems like what's also very important at that stage is identification.
And I can let you finish and we can come back to that because that might be a larger topic. But this might also tie into this idea of people seeking easy answers, right? If we are parroting beliefs, but we have this propensity towards wanting to identify things, it seems like those two things go together nicely, where it doesn't even matter if there's accuracy as long as I can put a label to something.
Yes, that's true. We'll cover that when we get to one of the components of logic, which sure. is definition. But yeah, when the child first gets the idea, he's getting the genus of it. So everything that a child encounters that becomes a belief is a large picture, the general form of it. Now, sometimes when he gets into the pert stage, as Dorothy Sayers called it, which is this argumentative stage, and you're not only arguing with the people around you, you're arguing within your own right. within your own mind.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that people have a hard time accepting, is that puberty has more than a sexual component to it. It's also modifying the computer, which directs the software of the mind. The computer, the hardware, is the brain. The software is the mind. So we have a mind and a computer when we're younger, but at the pubescent stage, there's something that occurs there as well. And it's the two halves of the brain starting to act more independently. And one half of it asks a question of another. And sometimes these become oral questions. But there is this idea of trying to differentiate the various, let's go back to our example of truth. I see this word being used or overused, as you say, and yet I see it used in different contexts. The one denotative word, truth, has many connotations.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, for example, Sanskrit was devised to avoid, so that each word has one and only one definition. I understand, for example, that there are 32 distinct words for water in Sanskrit. Now, I can't even imagine how you can take the term water and think of 32 different uses for it. But these ancient people did.
Okay, so each one is like a slightly different function or attribute or just something that clearly differentiates it from exactly. some other function or attribute to remove confusion.
You've got it.
Okay.
So we're not speaking Sanskrit. So we've got to deal with the situation that we face. What is truth? So start with that very simple definition of truth and then test your beliefs against it. And this, we've all been told in school, and we particularly become aware of this in middle school, you're a lazy thinker. Mm-hmm. You're not applying yourself. And there's no definition to that. How do you become an unlazy thinker? How do you apply yourself? So right there, you're getting a little bit of a contradiction from an authority who's saying that you're a lazy thinker. And the only way to become an unlazy thinker is to continue to work on this process of thought that is innate to you, rather than having it disturbed by the very people who are accusing you of this. And you address this very, very well and very succinctly in your series, that children are not defective.
Mm-hmm.
They are not the defective ones. The people who, I don't want to become pejorative of people, because they all came down the same road we did, but they were essentially culturized as we are. So they really, they're throwing out these words without having definition to them. You're a lazy thinker. Well, how do you suggest that I address that? Now, the thing about starting the trivium study is, once you get into it, particularly into the logic stage, it starts running in the background, as I had previously mentioned. And you don't have to consciously work on being a better thinker. What it's doing is starting to open your mind to be more curious. And after a while, curiosity is not a chore.
Right.
It's a motivation to come to know and understand ever more. And that's really how we have advanced as a species, is some of us have done that, have been able to do that. And we all have the potential to do that.
As we talk about this, and let's compare it to, as we've done so many times before on this show and others, let's compare the mind to a computer. And the input processing and output model that we've been using here, there's this program that runs in the background kind of as virus protection, we could say.
Yes.
Is really the four components of logic.
Correct.
Okay.
This is where you come to an understanding by eliminating, as I say, the contradictions that either you personally hold in your having grasped a subject or a topic, or that are present within the statement itself of the topic. So you see, there always seem to be two components or more to whatever we face. And I said that one of the things that the trivium or this process, this three-step process of thinking does is define or discerns reality from unreality. So what it's really doing is building discerning judgment. And I had been involved with several homeschooling families who have a religious background. Mm-hmm. And whenever I use that term judgment, that's a trigger word, that you are not to judge anyone.
Mm-hmm.
You are not to use that particular term. And I mean it in the sense what they are using the term judgment, and here we are with one word that has multiple meanings. What they're actually talking about, and they haven't discerned it themselves, is they're talking about prejudice, pre-judgment. Don't bring your unfounded pre-judgment to me or to my actions or to my thinking. Whereas judgment is this ability to discern reality from unreality. What is true. And the state of the art of the computer that humans have is this ability to judge. We are not infallible. Because we are fallible beings, we must know, or to the best of our ability in the circumstances that we face in life, is to know what choice to make. So this is what I mean by judgment, discerning judgment, or I often call it prudent judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And prudent judgment is a lot like wisdom. Wisdom is actually knowledge and understanding that you can use in the real objective world. If it's knowledge and understanding that you cannot use in the real world, it's not wisdom. So this goes along to that, to address that same differentiation.
I wanted to move into an actual discussion of these four components of logic. And I'm wondering if I should clarify a little bit. When I mentioned the input processing and output model of our minds or of a computer before, I would say the entire four components of logic, the entire process of logical reasoning is really the processing. Maybe the virus protection really deals more with one of these components that we're going to get to, and that's an understanding of the fallacies. But
yes,
we can start with a discussion of deductive reasoning here.
Well, we really have to go to reasoning itself.
Sure.
And there is two basic ways of reasoning, and let's parse that word reason. It has its basis in Latin, which is to reify is to thing make. When it's valid and true, you can take a thought and make it real in the real world. If you have a thought to take wood and fashion it into a chair, this is reifying. A chair doesn't exist or never has existed in nature until someone first had the idea of chair and then built this thing, reified it, made the thing itself from his own mental map. And now he's got something in objective reality, which has never itself existed before. But now anyone can take their five senses, and there's a chair. So this is the idea that what man makes in the natural world starts as a thought.
Mm-hmm.
And you can also take something that you cannot actualize and try to reify it. And these are the ideas, for example, that are in mythology. you're trying to take this superhuman that we call one of the multitudes of gods that stand for the elements that we see around us. So one of these elemental gods we make into this personification of that element itself, either a thing, action, attribute, or relationship. But that really doesn't exist in objective reality. It does exist in mental reality or subjective reality. So getting back to our reasoning, we really can't talk about deductive or inductive reasoning without referring to both, because when we get to our mental processing, the mind does only two things when reasoning. That is, trying to reify something, make it real to us, either physically or as an idea. What is truth, for example? So the mind only does two things when it's thinking consciously or non-automatically. When we're using volitional conceptual thought, it either takes ideas apart or puts ideas together. Now, when you're taking ideas apart, this is deduction. You're taking a general observation. You have observed something in your surroundings, and you're trying to explain it. So you more and more specify, how do I take this idea apart into its components for understanding?
Mm-hmm.
So I take the whole idea apart down to its component. And if I do that properly, if it's something that I've observed in objective reality, it is true. Now, where did you get this idea of the general component to look at? And this is inductive reason. We induce our five senses to see or to perceive what is around us. And really the only way that we have found that we can induce or to use this line of reasoning is the five senses. That's why the five senses are so important, and they've been denigrated in our modern culture, as I say, that you can't trust your five senses. Well, trust your five senses. You can trust, and the only way that you can do the inductive take in is through your five senses and point. It's called ostensive proof. The only way that you can prove something is that you point at it. Now, for example, a color. I can point at the color red, and you'll know what the color red is. There's no way that I can describe to you what the color red is, and you come to the idea that it's red, other than a relative situation. Well, it's a primary color, and it's not blue, and it's not yellow. Well, the only of the three primary colors left is red.
Mm-hmm.
But here you are with a body of knowledge already. See, you have deduced color from the general idea, from this abstract idea of color. You have deduced the idea of red. That's a deduction. So you use these processes of observing and then deducing. Now, where does the color red differentiate from the color orange? Now, here you're inducing again. This is very much like the idea of the grammar and then coming forth to the topic of today, the process of understanding. And then if you don't have enough, or you've made an additional observation, let's get back to this dance of induction, deduction, induction, deduction. And as we refine our thought and move forward, and especially as we communicate this to others, which will be the topic of our next conversation, which is rhetoric, the test of our knowledge and understanding. But this is why you can't separate deduction from induction in the living of real life, in life situations. Now, Aristotle came up with the idea of logic and his description of deductive logic, of taking general observations and then taking them apart mentally to bring about an understanding. And this is his syllogism, which in Greek just means connected discourse. And this is the idea that thoughts are connected. thoughts are complex. There are multiple components to thought or to deduce from a general principle. So there is a defined process, which actually he didn't devise, but he is the one who brought it to the West and saw its value to use this set of rules, set of suggestions, really, as to how to take general observations apart.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the syllogism, which is, as I say, this connected discourse in which there are no contradictions within the statement. So everything follows. One of the definitions of logic is the art of valid inference.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, inference is the thought process itself, that process that we go through. And validity refers to this idea that all things are connected. There is a connected discourse, which in the end comes out to be a syllogism. And the syllogism itself has a number of components, which are really too technical to cover in more informal conversation.
Right.
So you can go to the syllogism and see the various components therein. But it's the study of the syllogism which actually starts to order your brain. This is where you start to have this, in our computer analogy, you're starting to program your brain so that it tends not to accept contradictions. And I give the objectivists the nod for coming up with the other definition, which is the art of non-contradictory identification.
Mm-hmm.
And identification itself is really the terms of definition. But these thought processes, not to overcomplicate these things, is that deduction is just taking ideas apart from general observations.
Mm-hmm.
And induction is taking in that observation through your five senses. As I say, the test of an induction is that you point to it.
And if anyone is completely new to these concepts, you know, this is us again, like the trivium itself, making something explicit that our mind is seemingly naturally trying to do all the time. And one of the simplest and most common examples of deductive and inductive reasoning is problem solving, in that a problem identification, which is necessary to achieve a solution, is deductive. If you're thorough, presenting a solution is inductive. And what I mean by that is, let's take an example of, it's 2003. I'm a young history guy, and this war breaks out in Iraq, and I say, I don't like that. I've identified a problem. From there, without any knowledge of this method, maybe just because I had a real desire to explain it clearly to other people, to do the rhetoric effectively, ultimately to an audience of young students, I work from there back to try and understand exactly what is happening, already knowing that the people who want to present the information to me about the war in Iraq are trying to get one over on me in one way or another. So I'm wise to that at that time. And, you know, learn the components for myself, learn the grammar of that situation for myself the best I could with the resources I had at the time. And then I could, starting from the bottom up, after going through that reverse engineering problem, start engineering an alternative or a solution, which would be inductive.
Yes, there we are with that dance of induction and deduction. You obtain the information, you induce it from the media, and it may not be accurate, and it may be just a complete fabrication, whatever. But you induce it. So in order to determine if it's true, or to determine how you can exist within this situation, now you take it apart. You deduce from the data that you have induced.
Mm-hmm.
And then to devise a solution for the problem, you're right. You come back to a solution, which is an induction,
right,
which can be deduced by someone else for validity and truth. This is why you can't take this process of deduction and induction without considering it. However, because the rules of deduction have been so technically parsed, mm-hmm. have been so technically taken apart, you can utilize that for that process of thought, for taking ideas apart. I've seen a lot of people talk about induction, because you simply point to it, as arbitrary. And this goes hand in hand, that an idea that is inductive, the idea of red, for example, or the idea of round, is arbitrary. But it's not arbitrary because our senses pretty much give us, all of us, the ability to observe the same objective item or object in the same fashion. And it's our interpretation, again, of what we see or of what we perceive in which there is conflict. So this is where this idea of deducing properly, of deducing through the rules of the syllogism, come into play. And because they're not perfect, the rules of deduction, the rules of the syllogism, we can get to an approximation, and then we can continue to refine from that. And getting back to this dance of induction and deduction, or the way our mind works,
right?
By putting together and taking apart to simplify the whole situation. And from this dance of induction and deduction, now we come to this idea of identification, which is defining.
Right.
The reason I wanted to present the four components of logic in the order that we did, that we take induction and deduction thought processes first, is that when we get to definition through genus and differentia, we are again looking at induction, which is the general form, and differentiation, which is taking the general form apart, what makes it different within a class. So, for example, the genus of red is color,
mm-hmm.
and red is a component of the general term color.
Right.
So that's its genus. Now, what makes red different within the class is what distinguishes it. It is not the color blue. It is not the color yellow. It is not the color these other components which make up the color red. So what you define it as is, when you are defining, one of the rules of definition is that you define what something is or possible rather than what it is not.
This is probably why we see the word finite in definition. And this also would solve the problem if we had 32 words for a thing
yeah.
and all its different forms and attributes and states instead of one word with a variety of misinterpretable meanings.
Mm-hmm. This is exactly where it happens. So you can see that we can go wrong in a lot of different ways. And that's why it's important that we work on these sets of tools to focus the way we see the world so that we can see it in a true and valid fashion. But when you get to definition or identity, identifying something, that's all identity is. It's defining what it is. And there is a process of doing that, finding out first what is the general category into which it fits and what makes that one different. We see a general category of animals that fly. Well, some of them have feathers and lay eggs, but there are others that don't have feathers and give birth to their young and nurse them. So we've got the general category of bats and the general category of birds.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at feathered birds, and we see one that's white, and generally it's white, and it's around the coast, the coastal areas, and they get to be a pretty good-sized bird as birds go, and we can say that that's a seagull. And so we differentiate what makes a seagull different from an ostrich. The ostrich doesn't fly. It's a flightless bird, even though it doesn't fly, which is one of the major attributes of birds. But it's feathered. It gives birth through a fertilized egg and so on and so forth. And at one time, it did fly. So this is the way we come to identify
mm-hmm.
by this inductive method and deducing, or genus and differentia, the general category, and then the one that distinguishes the special category or the species within the genus. And this is usually used in the discipline of biology,
mm-hmm.
is that we see species within a genus, that the genus is a bird, let's say, and the species is seagull or ostrich. So these three terms can be used together when identifying genus. What is the general category? Differentia, what makes that one different? so that it becomes a species within the genus.
And all that encompasses Aristotle's method of defining.
Yeah. And you can see how it's tied into the thought processes of induction and deduction.
Right.
That's pretty much it.
Uh-huh.
There is the general category. And then when you differentiate a member of that category, it has characteristics that are different from all others within the category. It has mostly similarities to all other members of the category. But this particular differentia, or a number of differentia, make it unique within there, and that's the species.
All right.
And I was using birds as that, because it was easier to work with birds than it is with color, because color is difficult to specify. It's one of those things you have to point to. It's an ostensive category.
So then really, just to capture the idea of the rules of definition, it's genera and differentia.
Yes.
All right.
The general category.
Yep.
And then what distinguishes it, what makes it different in the category, shows you its special place within the general category, and that's its species.
So those are the first three categories of logic. The fourth, and this is the one that we've spent the most time on School Sucks in the past, deals with the informal fallacies, which I've referred to as kind of an alarm system. You know, even though this is the trivium being applied out of the proper order, we're thrown into a world as public school graduates, a world already in progress with the illusion of being learned. So you mentioned this feeling of intuition before. Something didn't feel right about what I was just told or what I just experienced. So we can take that intuition into an understanding of this system, figure out what the problem was, what the contradiction was, but it basically acts as an alarm system for things that are already being thrown at us in the world.
Yes, it can be called an alarm system. Aristotle himself called it... And Richard Grove focused on this. He called it intellectual defense.
Mm-hmm.
Aristotle said that it was manly. Of course, he was thinking in terms of, in warlike terms, but it was manly to be able to defend yourself physically, but no less so than intellectually.
Mm-hmm.
And the formal, we're really focusing on the informal fallacies, which are general fallacies that have come to be listed by using the first three components that we were talking about: induction, deduction, and definition. So this is the result of seeing common errors in methods of thinking. When I was being given the trivium by my mentor, we did not spend much time on fallacies, because my major focus, again, was the mechanical art of dentistry, so definition had to be the major component there.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentioned to me that with this dance of definition, which is really induction and deduction as well, with this dance within this discipline of logic, that your prudent judgment will start to become focused, that this is how you start to trust your own thinking, is that your judgment, the interpretations that you give to yourself internally, or even those that you speak about, are in harmony with objective reality. And that using this idea of identification, of identifying things, gives you more and more trust in your own thinking, or really what I'm saying is your own prudent judgment. And that is true. And it's a subsequent product of doing this. This is, I had mentioned, there are a number of thinkers that say that you can study one thing that doesn't seem to have any relationship to another subject or topic, and yet it enhances your grasp of that other topic. And that's what induction, deduction, or the focus, the intentional focus on induction, deduction, and definition does. And so the informal logical fallacies are products themselves of this induction, deduction, and identification or definition. And this has been found to be used in a lot of the ways that we look at things, and it came out of the mythological mode of thinking. There are only 16 fallacies that I was provided with pretty much toward the end of my tenure with this dentist, and they've really served me all my life. I did not commit them to memory. I've made cards that I carry in my wallet throughout my life. There's only 16 of them, but they're not that central to my way of thinking, because I've already got this method running in the background of how to identify, how to accurately bring my understanding into focus. Mm-hmm. So when I got into college, I took a course in philosophy, and one of the segments in there was the study of logic. And the way it was presented in college was we started with the fallacies. And I thought it was kind of an epiphany for me at that time. Of course, this is where you start the study, because you see the practical use of these very abstract ideas of definition, induction, deduction, and so forth. But these are actually the products of that thinking, of the grammar and the first parts of logic. And they all relate to three general categories. Is the error relevant? Is the error presumptuous? Or is the error ambiguous? And those are just statements having to do with what is your conversation at the moment? Or what is the speech being given? Fallacies of relevance, for example, are the biggest fallacy that I can see is the appeal to inappropriate authority. Mm-hmm. Just because an authority says it so does not guarantee that it's true or that it's accurate.
Right.
Or appeal to pity. Your argument is you want to send money in because this little dog that's being shown on TV has been starved, and we're going to show you a number of other pets that are starved, and you should send in money to be because of the pity that you feel for them. Instead of the greater ethical or moral idea is that we should address the abuse of these animals that we call pets. Or maybe we should address the abuse that we bring upon our children. Mm-hmm. So there are reasons, legitimate reasons, to do these things other than these other appeals. The appeal to force is another. Do this particular action because I'm going to hit you with a bat if you don't do it.
Right.
So the idea is not that you're doing it for a particular ethical reason, but you're doing it out of fear.
Right.
And this is one of the most prevalent of all the errors that we see, that we're doing things out of fear because we're going to suffer a consequence.
Yeah, we learned that one early, very early in life.
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
Yes, we do.
You also covered in your dog example, you also covered the irrelevant conclusion where, to a certain extent anyway, where a problem is presented. And then at the bottom, you know, as you work through this argument, whatever the real conclusion might be to work towards solving that problem is pulled out, and some alternative conclusion, usually very beneficial to the person who presented the argument, is slid in its place. I covered this in a series I did about teachers unions, where our schools are terrible and kids aren't able to learn anything. I said, I agree. What's the solution? More money for teachers unions was the solution that was slid in there. I said, ooh, I disagree. There's got to be, my intuition told me there was something wrong with that. And sure enough, that was a fallacy of relevance.
Well, there you go. You're starting to see how all these things work systemically. They are systems. One of these fallacies often doesn't occur on its own. There are several fallacies. As I say, I only have 16 of them that I carry around. But there are usually several fallacies. Just like you can't really use induction without deduction. Mm-hmm. It is a system. I haven't used the terms in this particular discussion that I used in the last, but it brings this this viewpoint of also and rather than either or. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes when you see statements in error, they'll have, because they're so common, people just make these errors in statement all the time. another error of relevance, which we encounter quite often, is the argument from ignorance. And that's really the ignorance of the audience. And right now I'm going to use terms that come out of our next conversation, which is on rhetoric. But again, you can't discuss one of these components of the system without often making reference to another component. But the argument from ignorance, its Latin name is ad ignorantium, is really about the audience. In rhetoric, there is the speaker, and then there are the terms that he uses, and there's the audience. And this is called a rhetorical triangle, or it's one aspect, or one of the rhetorical triangles. Mm-hmm. So a speaker is speaking to you, and he's counting on your being ignorant. He's denoting something to you, but counting on your taking a different connotation, and that you're going to be ignorant of one fact, that a negative cannot be proven. Only a positive can be proven. And that's why in definition, you want to use a statement that is positive. You want to state what is rather than what it is not. But the reason this ignorance occurs in the audience, you as the audience, is the statement is being made of something that cannot be shown. One example is in economics. There are schools of economics which talk of the idea that there is a computation for lost opportunity. Mm-hmm. The classical example is someone intentionally goes up to a merchant's storefront and breaks his storefront window. Now the merchant has to spend time and money to get that window replaced. And the idea is, well, isn't that good for the economy? Because now he's hiring a glazer, somebody who works on windows, and a carpenter to repair this. So this is keeping the flow of money going throughout the economy. Mm-hmm. And the argument against that is no, because he would have taken that money and spent it elsewhere. He would have spent it maybe not on those particular craftspeople, but on something else. Maybe on a dress for his wife or something like that. So the idea is that you can calculate the cost of the missed opportunity or the alternate use of those funds. Mm-hmm. But if it didn't happen, you can't. All you can do is approximate it. However, because you can determine what he spends with the glazer and the carpenter, that is a positive. In other words, if something is not or did not happen, how can you quantify or how can you prove it?
This argument that you're mentioning, which is usually referred to as the broken window fallacy, is usually employed to talk about money that was obtained by Austrian economists to talk about money that was obtained in an illegitimate fashion. So therefore, it's an opportunity cost. Now, I agree with what you're saying that it does kind of seem to be a zero-sum game. In other words, like the money is changing hands either way, right? Unless it's being put into a mattress, it's going somewhere. So that argument always made sense to me. But it didn't seem if it mattered, as far as just the money changing hands aspect of it, it didn't seem that it mattered one way or the other. The problem is more of the initiation of force. The problem is that somebody broke a window, right? And that creates, all these, you know, unforeseen circumstances and headaches for the shopkeeper. But when you talk about it in the terms you just used in that explanation, you're right. You really can only, the only thing available for evaluation is what happened, not what might have happened.
Yeah, exactly. As I say, you can come to an approximation, but a lot of times in economics, the authority, the economist is telling you that this is the case. And if you are not aware of your own ignorance, that only a positive can be proven, mm-hmm. and a negative or what is not cannot be. Now, I'll use another term. When somebody says, and I've used this in the past, there's a green gremlin over in the corner. Well, the green gremlin is in the same category as a unicorn. And you, as the audience, from the speaker who's claiming the green gremlin say, I don't see it. And he says, well, I tell you that it's there. And you insist, well, I don't see it, so it's not there. And he says, I say it's there. You prove that it's not there.
Right.
There is no way you can prove that it's not there. That's why the argument from ignorance has an appendage to it, and it's called the onus of proof principle, that the one who claims that something is so must prove it. It is not incumbent upon you as the audience to prove something is not, because you cannot. If it is not there or it did not happen, it cannot be proved. So this is the place you have to extract your ignorance from, that only a positive can be proven. This idea of the green gremlin or something that you cannot sense or that is a figment of imagination for you to disprove is impossible. So the negative in this argument, the negative in logical thinking always holds the field. It doesn't say that the opposite is true. You're not making a definitive statement. All you're saying is the negative, because the person who makes the claim has not proven it to you, the negative holds the field. You assume the negative. And again, this is a soft position. It's not a hard position, which you can take in proof. I'm standing next to a chair. Oh, I see the chair. Well, if I'm standing in front of the chair and the audience can't see it, you're saying I have a chair here.
Mm-hmm.
The audience can't see it. No, I don't see it. There's no chair there. So you stand aside and the chair becomes visible. You, as the one who says that there is a chair in your proximity, have proven that the chair is there. And you've proven it by that person using his senses to perceive it. So that's an important one because it's so subtle. Fallacies of relevance. Is it relevant that there's a green gremlin over there?
Right.
And then the second category of fallacies is presumption. Circular reasoning. False cause. Cause and effect are not in alignment. A lot of people get cause and correlation confused. I just recently had somebody who was trying to get her head around what Bitcoin is.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife is getting tired of my constant lament, what is money? Because it's a very subtle thing. But what is Bitcoin? Well, nobody knows who came up with the unbreakable code to assure that Bitcoin is never broken into. Well, what is it? There's going to be 21 billion Bitcoin that are going to come into existence and no more. And this is just the idea that we use gold for money because it had a finite existence. There was only so much gold that you could get. It was difficult to come by, so you use that as money.
Mm-hmm.
So the context that this person was using for the Bitcoin was just recently there was a person who started up a site.
If this is Silk Road,
correct.
There was some bad, just to clarify, as far as my understanding, and people can do their own research on this, Silk Road was primarily set up to sell gray and black market items. Then there was an allegation against this founder or manager of the site. It's unclear who he is, that he commissioned a hit on somebody else. So that's the story that I understand it at this point. But it was my understanding that it was primarily a place, if people are totally unfamiliar with Silk Road, where you could go and buy drugs.
That was the focus of this person's argument. And knowing me, she's around when I'm asking, well, what is money? So what is this Bitcoin? The argument she was trying to present to me is if Bitcoin didn't exist, this drug market, or all these other gray and black market items, as you mentioned them, would not be in existence. Well, the Bitcoin correlates with drug misuse, with assassination, with weaponry. All these things existed before Bitcoin did. So Bitcoin is not the cause of these various situations in the black and gray market. It's a correlation. Those would have gone in another fashion. This goes to rational thinking, that the essence of man is that he can perceive and use ratios. This is where the root of rational thinking, which can be used synonymously with reasonable thinking. From perceiving ratios in nature, a person can design an item in his head. And if it is valid and true, that is in accordance with that which is, or natural law, he can produce that. He can recreate the ratio. This is what rational refers to. As far as we can see, there are no other animals that can perceive and use ratios. And the prime ratio, the ratio of 1:1 that correlates to man's existence with reality, with existence, is cause and effect. And along with existence and consciousness, the prime ratio, cause and effect, is what we have come to understand as being axiomatic. Within our purview, there is existence, objective resistance, existence. Mm-hmm. There is subjective consciousness, human conceptual consciousness. And part of that consciousness is the ability to see the first subtext of substance, which is ratio. And by coming to know ratio, we can control or start to control or modify our surroundings. And that's why men build. I often say that fish swim, birds fly, and man finds and uses ratios. And that is rational thought. A complex question. We're still looking at fallacies of presumption. A question that's asked in a way to presume the truth of a conclusion which is buried in the question, or leading questions. And this is really what you were speaking about with that gentleman who started with definitions, mm-hmm. and then proceeded from his definition rather than opening up a dialogue as to what the definition of what he was discussing was. What is your definition of God, in other words? So a complex question is, the easiest one is, do you want to be a good boy and go to bed right now? You're talking to your little child. And the child, if he knows it, he says, well, yeah, I want to be a good boy, but I don't necessarily want to go to bed right now. So
mm-hmm.
there is that leading question.
And that moves us from fallacies of relevance to fallacies of ambiguity.
Like equivocation, statements that are ambiguous within themselves. We've been talking about equivocation, mm-hmm. Using the same term inconsistently with different meanings or different senses within the same sentence, like the definition of liberal as being free. Something that's liberating is freeing. And then to free the mind so that it is open to its observations, so that it can be discerned by the individual himself, is liberating.
I just had a quick question about equivocation. Could this be, even if you change, does it have to be the same word, or could you equivocate on an idea?
No, it doesn't have to be a word. It can be an entire concept.
Okay.
It can be a complete thought. It can be an entire sentence or a group of sentences. Absolutely. And that's actually what I'm illustrating right now. Normally, you can find the word within the complete thought or the component. The complete thought is the genus, and you can find the component which is being equivocated upon, which is the species of the word within that is being used in two different senses. Like what I was just illustrating with liberal, in classical times, a liberated person meant that his mind was free to discern the world for himself, utilizing these guidelines of the trivium. Mm-hmm. And then in modern times, political liberals are those that are unstructured. They are free to think on their own, and there's no coherent structure. Therefore, their politics, their prescriptions for policy is unstructured.
Yes. Yeah.
They are essentially, what they're really trying to say is that they are sophistical, just like the sophists of old, who are philosophical pragmatists, someone who does not have a big picture or a long-term view of anything. He just wants to win, as you said, in the moment, right now. His range of thought is range of the moment rather than long-term thinking. And ethics have nothing to do with the pragmatist. All he is presented with a problem. He sees an opportunity in that problem and proceeds to use his whim to take advantage or solve it. Now, sometimes his whim can be in accordance with natural law, but oftentimes it's not. It's just so that he is getting the advantage for himself at the cost of others, or the use of force, initiating force. That is a philosophical, pragmatic position.
Mm-hmm. We covered composition and division, because you mentioned the sophistry of political debate and political speeches before. These seem to be two of the most common within the fallacies of ambiguity, composition and division. So I wanted to make sure we could touch on each of those, because they kind of work together as well. Well, they're opposites of each other, but they work together.
Yes, like so much does, also and mm-hmm. rather than either or. Composition is reasoning from attributes of the parts of the whole to the whole itself. So you can say that here I have a part of an automobile, a component of an automobile. It's a wheel and it's made of aluminum. It's very light. And the engine block itself is also aluminum. It's very light. And the body is made of aluminum. So it's very light as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can say that it's a light car. So go ask yourself to pick up that light car because it's made of light components. So it as a whole is going to be light. Well, it's not so light that you can pick it up. Maybe in relation to other cars, it's light. But here is that fallacy of saying that just because one component has this characteristic, as the specialized component is put into the general component, that the general category will have, by default, the characteristics of one component. And that's not necessarily so.
So it's an inductive error.
From the parts to the whole, yes, it is.
And division, on the other hand, would be a deductive error.
Right. The whole must be true of the parts. What's true of the whole must be true of the parts. Okay, I've got a very heavy automobile here. Therefore, the wheel is going to be quite heavy also. Well, it may be the aluminum wheel, which relatively is light. Now, here's one thing about fallacies. Fallacies are a red flag. They are not necessarily the whole picture. So whenever you have a suspicion of a fallacy, that means that there's further investigation to be made in order for you to come to a valid and true conclusion. Now, the valid and true conclusion may confirm the fallacy, but the fallacy in itself, if the statement is in the form of a fallacy, doesn't mean that the whole argument is wrong.
That's the fallacy.
This is really shown in these last two fallacies of composition and division. Now, after a while, for example, I mentioned that politics is one of the classical components of philosophy. What politics has come to be known as is other than ethical behavior in modern times. So because we see these politicians, mm-hmm. these talking heads on TV, you can pretty much generalize that whenever they're speaking with less than candor. They're probably using manipulation.
Right.
So you can make a general case for this. But if it's important to you as the individual, and that's really what the trivium is doing, is tuning up individuals so that society, culture itself, becomes more highly tuned, with each of its components becoming more tuned. And so by looking particularly at these two fallacies, composition and division, you can see how using the opposite of this, of tuning up the individual, can start to form a more ideal society. Not necessarily through policy, but through each individual starting to understand how to live cooperatively, naturally, with other individuals, to start becoming empathetic to the other person, who is essentially very much like you. And right now, in this period of aggression, we're thinking we're hurting other people, but we're really just, stepping on our own toes.
Agreed. So that concludes the three categories of informal fallacies. Relevance, does this belong here or not? Does this have anything to do with what we're talking about or not? Presumption, people adding things in that are not necessarily true or verifiable. And ambiguity, leaving the person who is the recipient of the argument with questions about what was actually said, or maybe even perhaps a deliberate attempt or a deliberate strategy of being unclear.
Yes, regardless of whether it's deliberate or not, if the argument is important to you, you want to investigate further. How do you investigate further? You go to the grammar, logic, etc.
All right. So before we wrap up today, I just wanted to ask you, I mean, obviously having all of this information is very important, and being able to work backwards from the fallacies into the deeper understanding of logic is also very helpful. Do you have any strategies that you would offer for people to try to detect these fraudulent arguments, aside from just having, you know, a hand list of fallacies with them?
Well, as I say, I have a total of 16. I'd be pleased to present that to you because they've served me all my life. And the fallacies, these various lists that have become popular are really just more specialized uses of a general fallacy. I don't know of a particular strategy. As you start to look at these, I think a more compact version, as I say, they're 16 fallacies that I use and broken up into these three categories. This might be the best strategy to use to become familiar with it, because as you get into the broken window fallacy, as you called it, we went back to one of the other more general fallacies, the special fallacy to the more general fallacy. And so these 16 that I have might prove helpful. As I say, I never really concentrated on fallacies because this program of the Trivium was already working internally. And this is what's so difficult to communicate to people. I understand. I've been asked, just give me general grammar. Just go ahead and write it out and give it to me. Then give me logic. Just write it out and give it to me. Just give me the rules of rhetoric and give it to me, and then I'll have it. It'll be spoon-fed to me. Mm-hmm. And the difficult part to communicate to people is it's not the framework itself, which is valuable. It's not the knowledge of the various fallacies in themselves, which is valuable. It's the product of using that thought pattern that is valuable in living life, in organizing your thoughts. And this cannot be like color. I can't describe in words what a particular color is. And I can't describe the benefits of making these studies, which will help you in virtually every other pursuit of knowledge and understanding that you'll come across in life. And this is why I've been so focused on children, because I find that adults, they can understand that there might be something there, but they don't know what it is. As I say, they want it spoon-fed to them. When you give this to children, as Dorothy Sayers suggested, when you give this to children, adolescents, and young adults at the right age, they simply ingest it. It makes sense to them because they're already more or less thinking like that. They have no prejudices to have to get rid of.
They have an uncluttered mind.
They have an uncluttered mind, and that's really the product of using the Trivium method, is to give you clarity of mind. You are holding no contradictions. Every piece of knowledge that you hold within your mind is of a whole. If it's of a particular topic, if it's all topics put together in a mythological, a philosophic, or a scientific mode, it's of a piece. Your contradictions are minimal. And when you do have this idea of a feeling of cognitive dissonance, you investigate it. You now have the tools to investigate it and find where that contradiction is and clarify your mind on that particular point. That is the product of study and practice of the Trivium.
Yeah, and that would make perfect sense to me that, you know, one of the products of the Trivium is an uncluttered mind, and one of the natural attributes of a child's mind is uncluttered.
Yes.
Because the Trivium is a natural process, and until that's interfered with and corrupted, that's how things work. And we realize, like, even back to inductive and deductive reasoning, that a lot of these things seem intuitive, and making them explicit and saying, oh, these are tools, let's use tools, is helpful in all situations for better clarity, less contradictions, and less clutter. So next week, we'll do a quick review, and we'll deal with rhetoric. Thanks again for all this time.
Well, it's my pleasure, Brett.
I'm glad to hear that.
I have followed your growth since you started, and it's a gratifying thing to see.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.